Blog Talk Radio.
Ray, can you hear me? Ray, can you hear me?
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for July 3rd, 2023. I am Pro Wrestling July 2nd, 2023. I'm getting ahead of myself. This is Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and this is the post-Money in the Bank edition of Wrestling Night in America, even though it is not coming to you live after Money in the Bank. And there's a good reason for that. So yesterday, which was Saturday, my fiance threw my future mother-in-law a surprise birthday party. And it was supposed to start at 7:30. That's when her mother was supposed to come to the party. And I thought maybe, just maybe, if there was a hard out after 3 hours that I could do Wrestling Night in America after Money in the Bank and make it over to the house for the surprise. As Money in the Bank continued, I realized that there was no way that I was going to make it. So rather than be late to the party, miss the surprise, and do the show after Money in the Bank, I decided, for the sake of my relationship, to postpone the Money in the Bank post-show to our regular night, which is tonight, Sunday, 8 p.m. Eastern. So that's the long and short of why our post-Money in the Bank Wrestling Night in America is not going on the air after Money in the Bank. But the nice part about it is usually I go solo on the episode when it's right after a pay-per-view. Tonight, I have the pleasure of joining or having someone join me, and that someone is PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire, who has written extensively about Money in the Bank already. Brandon, thanks for joining me tonight.
Absolutely. Glad to be here. And, Greg, you were the target audience for the message that WWE was sending loud and clear for a couple weeks, which was, you know, it's a Saturday afternoon. You can watch Money in the Bank at the beach. You can watch it on your phone. You can bring it to your family party.
Yes, I bring it to the family party. I could do, however, host Wrestling Night in America at a family party. Not as doable, especially because my fiance is Colombian. Her whole family, they love when they get together to party. Very loud. There's lots of music, and there is no nook nor cranny in that house that I could have done the show where you wouldn't have heard music blasting in the background. So again, here
we are.
So you're
telling me it could have been a unique episode.
It would have been unique. Absolutely. I'm not sure if that is a good thing or a bad thing, however. So that's why we do it tonight. Brandon, before we go through the matches, and what we'll do is we'll go through each match. We'll give our take on it. We'll go to the phones. We've got some emails to get through as well. If you want to join us live, 515-605-9345. If you want to send us an email, WNIALivecast@gmail.com. For me, Torch columnist Greg Parks, as well as PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire. Brandon, when I write my roundtable review that appears in the Torch newsletter, I score the show on a 1 to 10 scale. I sent that in earlier today. It'll be in this week's Torch newsletter, so I don't want to give away the score that I gave. But 1 to 10, if you had to put a number on it, what would have been your score for Money in the Bank?
Oh, man. So I usually, for my reports for PWTorch.com, I usually subscribe to the VIP post-show roundtable format in basically for simplicity's sake. So I usually go thumbs up, thumbs in the middle, thumbs down. This was certainly a thumbs up show for me, which to me indicates, you know, thumbs in the middle, I would say, would be high four into the, you know, maybe mid to high sixes. I think I'd go, man, 7.5 to 8, I think.
Okay. And, again, my review with my score will be in the Torch newsletter this coming week, so you can see where I scored compared to what Brandon gave it. Let's go right down the show here, match by match. We started with Damian Priest in the opener winning the Money in the Bank ladder match on the men's side over LA Knight, Logan Paul, Ricochet, Shinsuke Nakamura, Santos Escobar, and Butch. I thought this was probably in the running for best match of the night. I thought they did a really nice job of – I thought there were two real potential winners here, Logan Paul, Damian Priest. You could have made the argument for LA Knight as a dark horse if WWE really wanted to capitalize on his sudden babyface I don't even know what to call it, renaissance. Although WWE has not really been known to change horses in midstream like that, historically speaking. So Priest gets the victory. I thought this was the right call. And I thought they really did a nice job using LA Knight's reactions to get Priest more over as a heel and to really add drama, mm-hmm. because they didn't shy away from the idea of teasing LA Knight as a winner and using that heat to, you know, continue to kind of tease the fans and allow others to make their moves as well.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And that was sort of my takeaway point when I was watching the show and covering live yesterday, was that there was definitely a push to make it clear that the company is very much aware of the groundswell of support building around LA Knight. And I thought that they parlayed that really well into getting heat on Damian Priest. Like you said, they put LA Knight in a number of situations there at the end where over and over again, he looked like he was about to win. So LA Knight, you know, tosses Ricochet. He tosses Shinsuke Nakamura. He takes down Santos Escobar. And each time he's getting closer and closer to the briefcase and he's being thwarted by the next guy in line until eventually it's Priest that gets the ultimate cutoff with the broken arrow off of the ladder for the finish. So I thought it was really smart. It was smart to play into the idea that not only could Knight win, but I think each time Knight tossed a guy out of the ring or prevented a guy from kicking him or pushing him off the ladder, the belief built in the fans' mind that he could win, because you feel like they're only going to do that spot so many times before they actually go with a winner. So I thought it worked really nicely to build and build and build and build and then have Priest be the one to cut him off at the knees. So I think it worked. I agree too that, you know, if you set aside the groundswell for LA Knight, the two obvious winners in this match, two obvious potential winners, were certainly Damian Priest and Logan Paul. And if you want to put it on the guy who is there weekly, who can be constantly teasing the usage of the briefcase, then I think that ultimately, you know, you made the right call with Damian Priest. The only upside, I think, to putting it on someone like Logan Paul is that you get a less traditional Money in the Bank summer and fall if the briefcase lasts that long. And by that, I mean that really only Brock Lesnar has been a Money in the Bank winner who isn't around all that much, whereas usually you have the Money in the Bank winner there every week, and so WWE often feels the need to tease a cash in almost too frequently. So I do suspect we'll get that with Priest, whereas we wouldn't have with Logan Paul.
What's the ceiling for LA Knight with these reactions he's been getting?
Well, you know, there's been so much talk lately about WWE having some hesitancy to push LA Knight because of his age, but
I mean, if you just look at the birthdays, Damian Priest is actually a bit older than LA Knight. So I don't really see the age as being a disqualifying factor at this point. Wrestlers' careers have certainly increased in longevity over the course of this generation. I mean, you have guys like Shinsuke Nakamura and like AJ Styles who are wrestling, you know, competitively and at a relatively high level well into their 40s. So I don't see age being an issue for Knight. So really it comes down to where WWE is going to allow him to go. I mean, if these reactions continue to build and this groundswell continues to happen, it's going to be really hard to ignore, and I think you're going to have to consider him for a much more prominent role. I don't know if that means a run as U.S. champion when you finally, you know, decide to move on from Austin Theory's title reign, or if it means moving him up the card. I don't see him as a legitimate or viable challenger to Roman Reigns right now. I think that he would have to be over on Raw for him to be competing for the world title right now. So I don't know. I think if things stay the way they are, I don't see Reigns losing the championship anytime soon. Of course, we've heard rumors of what their plans are there. So I guess for the time being, I'd say that the ceiling is around the U.S. title, which means a lot more now than it would have, you know, just a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly, I mean, with his babyface reaction, unless Seth Rollins loses the title, I don't see him challenging for that. You know, you could do
right.
a challenge on an episode of TV. Like if Damian Priest cashes in some point soon and LA Knight is still getting the reactions he's getting, you could do Priest versus LA Knight on an episode of Raw, I think.
Sure.
Although Knight on SmackDown would make it tough, but who knows?
Right,
you know, they've been able to finagle that before. You know, but they do have the, you know, Priest and Knight were both in Money in the Bank together, so you could make some kind of reasoning for Knight to challenge Priest based on what happened in that match. But yeah, Knight being on SmackDown makes it tougher if you are WWE and you're doing a hard split and you're not going to allow Knight to cross over, which is, you know, I think if WWE knew this kind of reaction for him was coming, they might have put him on Raw. That way they could have really taken advantage of it and could have had him seriously challenge the champion on that brand. But who saw
you're,
it coming?
Yeah, you're,
I certainly did.
I know. You're really hamstrung with any character who may get hot on SmackDown because there just isn't a place for them to rise up. I mean, they can rise, like I said, to the level of the U.S. championship, but all they can really do is lose to Roman. I mean, the likelihood that someone comes along with a rocket strapped to their back that's just so undeniable that you can't do anything but have him be the one to dethrone Roman instead of Cody Rhodes, that just seems incredibly unlikely. So with that in mind, I mean, it really puts a ceiling on guys that are on SmackDown right now.
Match number two was Liv Morgan and Raquel Rodriguez winning the women's tag titles over Ronda Rousey and Shayna Baszler when Baszler turned on Rousey and allowed Morgan and Raquel to win the titles. So this was really odd and out of left field until you read the follow-up. I think Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer came out and said that Ronda Rousey is going to be done around SummerSlam time, probably after SummerSlam, which would allow the build for Rousey versus Baszler to take place at SummerSlam. I think that that's an attractive matchup on paper, but I do wonder if the haphazard nature of the turn will – and we haven't heard the explanation from Shayna Baszler, so maybe she's able to salvage it. But I do wonder if the surprise nature of the turn will hamper the build or the anticipation for that match if indeed we get it at SummerSlam.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of how they went about this in the moment. You know, before knowing about the reasoning behind it, at least from a, you know, outside of storyline perspective. I thought that it felt rushed. It came out of left field. It didn't really make any sense. And more importantly, I thought that, you know, this was one of the first times in a while that I could remember Ronda Rousey having any sort of positive momentum. And then you carry that over to Shayna Baszler, who really this is maybe the first time on the main roster that she's had any significant momentum. They've just never been really sure how to utilize her as a single star on the main roster. So I thought it was nice that she had finally found some footing in this tag team with Ronda Rousey, and it felt like a natural pairing. So to turn on Rousey out of nowhere felt just really, really disjointed. And I thought the crowd reaction kind of played into that as well. It also left me confused as to what their intended designation for the two was going to be, because the way that Shayna turned would obviously dictate that Ronda Rousey would be the babyface here. But I just don't think that there's any interest from the crowd in cheering Rousey. So you've right. immediately put yourself in a really disadvantageous position. And then the news, like you mentioned, Greg, comes out that it seems to be that Rousey has a hard out with her contract and wants to work with Baszler. Well, that's great, but they obviously knew that Rousey had a hard out. It's not like they just suddenly discovered that her contract is up and that she's leaving. Why didn't they plant any seeds? I mean, why didn't they build to this? Why didn't they put some sympathy on Ronda, or better yet, maybe put some sympathy on Shayna, because I think you'd have an easier time getting the crowd to cheer her than you would Ronda at this point. It just seems like that's not something that comes out of nowhere. They should have had the foresight to plan a little for this.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is maybe the couple things at play here. They either thought that they were going to re-sign Ronda beyond
right.
SummerSlam, or that she'd work beyond SummerSlam if that's when her contract is up and something happened last minute and she said, nope, I'm not doing it. Or, you know, we've seen her take hiatuses before while she's been under contract. And maybe she's still under contract. And maybe it's just another hiatus that she's told them she's taking, and she's a big star and she can get away with that. And WWE, I mean, clearly this wasn't something that WWE saw coming for whatever reason. Otherwise, I think they would have done, just as you said, plant seeds. We've seen a lot of seed planting for things like that under Triple H's creative. So I don't think this is something that they had planned on happening. So whatever the case may be, it seems like it was a surprise to them for whatever reason. I want to ask about the new tag champions and whether or not this gets their reign off on the wrong foot, Liv Morgan and Raquel Rodriguez, the fact that they won the titles because, you know, Shayna turned on Ronda and walked out on her. So really, the babyfaces won the titles in a two-on-one situation, which is not really a babyface thing to do. I mean, is that just going to be forgotten, or do you think that's kind of getting them off on the wrong foot right away?
It's not ideal. I mean, I think that Liv has built enough of a rapport with the crowd that they can probably overcome it just fine. And unfortunately, I just don't think that there's a lot of attention paid to the tag team titles in the women's division enough for it to make a significant difference or impact. Raquel's done okay for herself lately. I mean, the crowd doesn't seem particularly invested in her as a character, but I think that there is some interest in some of her power moves and her offense. So, I mean, I think they'll probably be okay, but I say that because I have a really low bar for what that division has been and what those titles have been. If things were different and it were booked a little bit better and the division were handled a little bit better, I would probably have a bigger issue with the way that they won the titles. But without Rousey and Shayna having really established a dominant run for any length of time, I don't think it'll end up being a huge deal.
They've got to get Raquel to stop smiling so much.
Yes,
ooh,
they do.
It's like it's so forced, and it's one of those you can see the Vince McMahon type things, you know, where he wants her to be a babyface and he wants her to smile all the time, and I think she's to the extreme, and it's not conducive to her character or getting over or anything like that. So anyway, match number three, Gunther versus Matt Riddle, Intercontinental title. Not much about the match. Gunther wins in about 8 minutes, retains the Intercontinental Championship, but the big news is Drew McIntyre returns. WWE, I thought, did a very nice job of setting the table for SummerSlam. You know, you've got Baszler versus Rousey. You've got Drew McIntyre versus Gunther with this match. And, you know, whatever the case may be, Triple H seemed to, in the post-show, kind of shrug his shoulders at the reports that, you know, the contract dispute and things like that. So who knows? But McIntyre versus Gunther, top-level SummerSlam match for Gunther, it seems.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, that Triple H's comments during the press conference, because I do believe at some point WWE was actually the ones to confirm that there was a contract situation with McIntyre. So funny to see them attempt to walk that back. But in any case, What was that?
That news must not have trickled down to Triple H.
In any case, though, like I thought that it was interesting to see how little mind was paid to Matt Riddle here. I think that we got a pretty good look at how the company may feel about him at this stage. I mean, and the thing is I'd be inclined to disagree if not for the pretty dramatic shift in crowd reactions for Riddle. I mean, when he was with Randy Orton, he was consistently one of the more over guys on Raw, and I think that has changed pretty drastically. I mean, you don't see large reactions for Riddle anymore. And even on the show yesterday afternoon, where this London crowd was rabid for almost everything that WWE threw out there, there just wasn't a whole lot of intrigue behind Riddle. I mean, granted, you know, Gunther being who he is and where the show was located, he was certainly always going to be the favorite in that match with the crowd. But we saw, based on instances earlier in the night, like during the Men's Money in the Bank, for example, where, you know, they had their favorites, but they were still willing to cheer babyfaces. And I just didn't get the sense that they had any interest in getting behind Riddle at all. And the match reflected that, and I think it sort of reflected how the company tends to be feeling about him these days. As for McIntyre,
If I can bring up Riddle, you know, I think that's something that's been since his return from his suspension.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was put in a theoretically prominent position, teaming with Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, but really, I mean, he was just there to take the pinfall. And he did quite often. So you could kind of read that, oh, you know, it looks like he's getting a push, but the way he was being used and being laid out all the time and being put through tables, and, you know, it was pretty clear that he was a means to an end in that feud. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it's, you know, the lack of Randy Orton and WWE doesn't really know what else to do with him. I don't know if it's just a lack of trust coming off the suspension. The WWE doesn't want to invest a lot of time and effort into pushing him beyond this. I mean, you know, he did make the SummerSlam card. He did get an Intercontinental title match, so there's that. But, yeah, it's clear he's been pigeonholed at a certain position, and it seems to be pretty far down the pecking order compared to where he was when he was with Randy Orton.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the gimmick that he has, I think that character has a ceiling, and I think we've hit the ceiling and he's now coming down from it. I just don't think that a gimmick that unserious all the time can really work as a main event caliber talent in WWE. So I think that if he's got a shot to sort of have any sort of resurgence up the card, I think we'd have to see a different character or a heel persona and see what that brings him.
And you were going to comment on McIntyre's return as well before I
interrupted. McIntyre, I thought the return was a great moment, a great spot. It was the perfect place to do it. He felt fresh. He felt rejuvenated, which is something he desperately needed. I think the time away certainly helped him in a big, big way. And, I mean, give me Gunther versus McIntyre all day long. I mean, just like Gunther and Sheamus, I was incredibly excited for that. I'm all for this this feud. I think it'll be great.
And we'll do one more match here before we get into the phone calls. Again, 515-605-9345 to chat with Brandon LeClaire and myself about Money in the Bank. Cody Rhodes versus Dominic. Cody Rhodes gets the victory. You know, this was about the crowd reaction. This was about Dominic's interactions with Cody, Dominic's interactions with Rhea Ripley, Rhea Ripley's interactions with Cody. It wasn't so much about the body of the match, which is a really good thing because Dominic, for all his improvements, still has a ways to go in the ring. And so, you know, the best thing for him was finding this character where he gets heat without even having to wrestle. And yes, he's going to wrestle now and again. And yes, he's going to get some big victories to sort of keep that heel heat that he has going. But this was, you know, this was kind of a get Cody and Dominic on the show because they're important parts of Monday Night Raw. But it wasn't anything beyond that. I didn't get the sense.
Yeah, this was exactly what it needed to be. Didn't need to be a good match. And it was fine. It was fine for what it was. It was exactly what I would expect out of Dominic at this stage of the game. This was, like you said, about crowd reaction, about continuing to push the envelope and push the buttons of people with this Dominic Mysterio character. And I think more than anything else, and most importantly, it was about buying more time for Cody Rhodes because Cody can't interact with the Bloodline right now and Roman Reigns, and Brock Lesnar is not around, and they've got one more match to do there. So this was all about keeping Cody Rhodes busy while maintaining his popularity with the crowd, and I thought it completely nailed both of those aspects.
All right, let's go to our first phone call of the evening. It is the 814 area code Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, welcome to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first question for us tonight?
First question is on Roman Reigns. Is there anyone you can see being brought into his fraction, considering he says left and he's been on a losing streak and silly? This isn't quite cutting it on getting him victories lately, at least in tag team action.
So someone brought in to be a part of the Bloodline, someone else? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, like an Ava Rain or anybody, like any of the other, like I heard something about his brother possibly being brought in. I don't know if that was just a rumor. I don't think he'd be ready for the main television.
I think Rikishi has another son that I've heard tell of recently. I don't think he's anywhere near ready to be a part of the Bloodline unless it's as a non-wrestling person. But I think there's always a way to add people to this to stretch things out. We've seen that now with Solo Sikoa. They brought him in, sort of stretch things out, add a different layer to the storyline. They've added Sami Zayn for a while. He's allowed the storyline to stretch itself out, tell new stories, and pad things out. So, you know, Brandon, I wouldn't rule out the addition of someone else to the Bloodline, but right now they're so laser-focused about dissension within the Bloodline, I'm not sure how you add another character to that unless Roman feels like, hey, you know, the Usos are out. There's not much of a Bloodline with just two of us, with Reigns and Solo Sikoa, so maybe if he faces Jay, and we'll talk about that tag match after the call with Ryan, that it was the main event of Money in the Bank. But, you know, do you see maybe in the lead up to SummerSlam, he tries to replace the Usos, say, look, we can get on just fine without you. We don't need you. We got these other members that we can bring in. Or whatever else the reason could be, do you see that as something that could be done either in the short term or the long term of the storyline?
I don't think so, at least not right now. I mean, I don't think that there's going to be any sort of clamoring internally or externally for the Bloodline to add members that aren't, you know, part of the Bloodline. So when you look at who conceivably they could go out and get, I mean, you know, Jacob Fatu always comes up. but I want to say that there's some circumstances that would prevent that, at least for the time being. I don't recall what they were, but it might be that he signed a contract somewhere or something along those lines. But there's also, of course, the Rock's oldest daughter, but she is down in NXT, doesn't really seem as though she's in a place right now where she would make a lot of sense to bring in. And also, you know, she would be in the women's division anyway, so it's not necessarily someone who would match up against the Usos. So it's hard for me to imagine anyone else being brought in at this stage of the game. I think what's more likely is they continue to tease out this relationship between Roman and Solo until eventually Solo goes his own way. I think that we're entering the end game stage of the Bloodline as we know it.
Interesting. Interesting stuff, Brandon. I don't know. It's got to be tempting for WWE because it's so successful to continue to stretch it out even beyond perhaps its shelf life. But I guess we'll see what happens.
And I don't think they've hit the shelf life yet either. That's the thing. So I don't think that they need to end it. I just wonder where you go with it. I mean, once it's just Roman and Solo.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Ryan, back to you for your second question for us.
My second question was, with John Cena teasing that WrestleMania could come to London, England, what could possibly be the main event on night two of that show that would be able to fill out like a Wembley Stadium?
That's it's hard to say because we don't know if or when that's going to be. So if it's 3 years from now, who knows what the main event could be? Do you go with they have wrestlers that are, you know, Europe based, whether it's Sheamus or Drew McIntyre or Gunther, who are all at the top of the card. They're all, you know, McIntyre and Sheamus getting on in years. Their bump card is filling up quickly, so if London is kind of 3, 4, 5 years away, it could be a little tougher. I think you just do a WrestleMania main event. I don't think you have to do it with someone, you know, England focused. I think if you have a strong enough card, I think if you have strong enough main eventers, Brandon, you can get away with just doing a quote-unquote normal WrestleMania main event.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, WrestleMania is WrestleMania. The brand is WrestleMania. I mean, the vast, vast majority of tickets for WrestleMania are sold well before a match is ever even announced. And I think that would certainly be the case with Wembley Stadium. AEW deserves a world of credit for what they've done with Wembley and All In. It is unbelievable, and it is a colossal success already. So, I mean, let's not pretend that WWE doesn't have ample drawing power there and couldn't at the very least do the same, if not more, with all of the cachet behind the WrestleMania brand. I mean, that country has been clamoring for a major event for decades now, really ever since SummerSlam 1992. So I think that, you know, they don't need anything other than the WrestleMania brand to make that a huge gate and a huge success. Will it happen?
I think the
man, I don't know.
Yeah, the other thing too is I would even argue that having a marquee main event for night two is even less important in this case because, you know, you're going to have, and maybe I'm underestimating the number of Europeans who come to WrestleManias in the States, but, you know, if you have a lot of people coming from the United States to go to this WrestleMania for whatever reason, because they want to be a part of the first, you know, WrestleMania outside the North America or whatever the case may be, you know, chances are they're going to both nights of WrestleMania. You know, they're not going to come for night one and say, well, now I got to get back. So, you know, I think that makes the main event of night two less important because the people who are going to be traveling there are probably going to be coming to both nights anyway. So, That's my takeaway, but that's a couple years down the line. It's really hard to pick main events for that right now. Ryan, back to you for your third and final question for us tonight.
Final question is, if you had to pick when Gunther would lose that title into who do you think he's going to break the record? And do you think he's going to, like, shatter that record by, like, a large amount of dates? Or do you think it's going to be, like, shortly after the record's broken?
You know, I go back and forth on this. I could see him holding the title for another several months. I could see him losing to Drew McIntyre at SummerSlam. I think the trouble with having him hold it so long is you're already doing that gimmick with Roman Reigns. And so it does feel like a, not second place, but it doesn't feel as important because you're already telling that story on a larger scale with a bigger star and a bigger title. So are you going to want to tell that same story at the same time with a smaller title on a smaller scale? As much as Gunther is over and as much of a great job as he's done against a variety of opponents in defending the Intercontinental Championship, I'm not sure that you want that to be the story around Gunther versus, you know, how is he going to get past Drew McIntyre or even, you know, losing the title of Drew McIntyre. I don't think that should be off the table because you want Gunther to break some kind another record in terms of length of title run or something like that.
Yeah, I think that that unlike Roman Reigns, where there's nowhere to go, you know, he's at the pinnacle. He's reached the top. There's no one above him. So there's nowhere to go technically but down. For Gunther, when he loses the Intercontinental Championship, he still has the ability to rise up to that world championship level. And I think part of the reason that they put Gunther on Raw and switched the second-tier championships was to create some distance between Roman Reigns and Gunther, because otherwise there is no mobility for anyone on SmackDown. They're just competing to lose to either Gunther or Roman Reigns constantly. So it necessitated that they get, you know, one of those titles away from SmackDown so that they can have a dominant champion across each show. But I don't think that it's the end of the world if Gunther loses to Drew McIntyre, because then he can go challenge Seth Rollins, and that's going to be a money program in and of itself. So I'm the same way. I mean, I could certainly see them going with McIntyre at SummerSlam. It's going to be a big match. It's going to have a big fight feel and a big stadium. I could see them holding off maybe for the next international show before they swap the title again, or, I mean, they could go an entirely different direction. But I hope they spend it wisely, because they've built a lot of positive cachet with that Intercontinental Championship and with Gunther's undefeated streak. And, you know, I think somebody like Drew McIntyre is probably the right type of guy to do it, because I just don't see anybody on the come up that makes a ton of sense right now.
All right, Ryan, appreciate the phone call this week. Hope to hear from you again soon.
Thanks for taking the call.
Let's go through the rest of the card here before we go back to the phones. John Cena makes a surprise appearance. I'm kind of surprised they were able to keep that under their hat.
Yeah.
But he's the one who got the talk of WrestleMania in London started. And then Grayson Waller comes out, badmouths John Cena, attacks John Cena. Cena AAs him, and that's it. So what did you make of Cena's mic work, the London thing, and Grayson Waller being the one chosen to interact with him in one of Cena's rare appearances?
So I'll talk about the positives first. I thought that, you know, keeping Cena under wraps, huge deal, really cool moment. The explosion from the crowd when the camera guys did a heck of a job too, the production crew, when they focused specifically on the lower bowl just as everybody was kind of sitting down and a lull was kind of entering the arena for the first time all night, because the crowd had been crazy all night long. And they're finally like getting this little reprieve and this little rest, and all of a sudden Cena's music hits. And the place just erupts. It was a really cool moment, and I thought they executed it really well.
I thought that Grayson Waller played his part nicely. I think I agree with a lot of the sentiment that I saw online during the show yesterday, which was that Grayson Waller seems to be what WWE wishes Austin Theory was. And I think that is very much the case. I can't think of many times in recent memory where someone has gotten a clean rub from John Cena and somehow come out significantly worse off from it. But Austin Theory is cold right now. So Grayson Waller, a good night for him overall, although on the negative side, and I thought there was a lot of negative to this segment, I didn't love that they decided to make Australia a heel for no other reason other than it wasn't England and it happened to be where Grayson Waller was from. I didn't mind Cena going out of his way to pitch for WrestleMania in London, though I do think it's a pretty cruel joke if they're not seriously considering it. But what I thought was really poorly executed and really, really poorly thought out was having Cena go out there and attempt to rile up discontent among the fan base about management not listening to them or not liking them and trying to sow some type of discontent between the audience and the company. This is the first time in almost a decade that WWE audiences, both in the U.S. and internationally, are largely completely in tune with what WWE is presenting on television. They should not be taking that for granted, and they certainly shouldn't be attempting to undo it by creating some completely false narrative that hasn't existed for almost 10 years, that hasn't existed in the last like couple of years, but was very prevalent for the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was weird. That was weird. Like you said,
it was
strange. We're at a time where WWE is, by most metrics, its most popular it's been in a long time. And so it just seemed kind of tone deaf, I guess, for mm-hmm. Cena to be making those comments. It seemed like someone who has been, which Cena has been, detached from the product for a while. For him to think that that's, you know, it gives the feel that WWE has passed John Cena by. And that's kind of mm-hmm. how it came across, if he was so off target in what he was talking about. And it's hard to get a read on Cena sometimes when he's doing these kind of promos because he's so far in character, you don't even know whether, like, is he building a straw man here? Like, does he even believe what he's saying? Was this his way of getting to the point he was making, which was London deserves a WrestleMania and might be getting one soon? Like, it was really hard to say based on how he was even talking about the situation. So I'm not really – yeah, it was very weird.
The counterpoint to my argument essentially is this idea that it's WWE speaking through John Cena attempting to drum up negotiating rights fees for international cities who want to bring major events to their country. So in other words, hey, like we haven't done this in the past because we haven't thought that the money is there and that the financials make sense. But if you want to throw us a bone and pay us to bring these events to your city the way that Saudi Arabia does, then perhaps we'll consider it. And maybe that's the case. And I don't necessarily have a huge issue with them believing that or with them attempting to do it. But you don't do that on television with an audience who has no say in this. I mean, they are not the representatives of the city. They themselves cannot, you know, throw WWE a stipend to send WrestleMania to London other than buying a ticket. So So I just didn't like the way that they went about it, if that was in fact what they were trying to do.
By planting this seed, wanting the fans to go to their local representatives and say, hey, we want you to bring WrestleMania to, maybe this, you know, they planted this seed, and now if enough fans create enough of a stir, maybe the elected officials in London are going to think about that. I mean, who knows what the strategy is on WWE's end.
You can still accomplish exactly that and leave out the part about management not caring about you and not liking you.
Yeah.
I mean, you could still have Cena go out there and say, I think London deserves WrestleMania. I mean, the message is simple and clear. It's everything that came in the lead up to it that seems so counterproductive. There's also, too, the argument, and I think Triple H was kind of alluding to this a little bit in the press conference when he was certainly hedging a whole lot more about the idea that this was a real viable thing. And I think he was doing so for a lot of the reasons that I've always hedged about the idea of WrestleMania going international, even in this new era where, you know, they can do these PLEs internationally because of having Peacock and prior to that having the network where time slots don't matter quite as much. People have to remember how big of an event WrestleMania is, not just for pro wrestling, but for entertainment in the United States in general. It's viewed similarly to major events like the Super Bowl, like the World Cup. Granted, it's not as large, but what I mean is that cities want WrestleMania. Cities bid on WrestleMania. Cities love WrestleMania because it attracts a ton of tourism and it brings tons and tons and tons of money to the local area. So WWE, being an American-facing company, is going to have a hard time explaining why they would take away that revenue from an American city.
Well, this is what Triple H was really saying was, London, if you want WrestleMania, you better pony up big time dough to make it worth our while.
You've got to offset.
Yes, exactly. So if you want it, because we're not holding this in the United States, I mean, you're really going to have to bid highly on this to get it. That's really what I think.
I mean, you look at like even Canada. You know, Canada being in North America, it's much easier for WrestleMania to go to Canada, but they haven't since 2002. And I mean, I think the large influx in interest from American football stadiums has been one of the biggest reasons that Canada hasn't gotten another WrestleMania.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's a big part of it. The next match was Io Sky winning the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match, defeating Bayley, Becky Lynch, Zelina Vega, Zoe Stark, Trish Stratus. This was the right decision, I think, to put Io Sky over. Her feud with Bayley needed, not really a feud, but the burgeoning feud with Bayley needed an extra kick to it. And I think this will jumpstart that down that path a little more than what we've seen. I thought it was a good showing from Zoe Stark as someone who certainly not the veteran like Trish or Bayley or Becky Lynch or even Zelina Vega. So I think she needed to stand out, and I thought she did a very nice job. Some moments that were a little iffy in this match, but I think ultimately the what people will remember is the finish with Becky and Bayley being handcuffed to each other between the rungs of the ladder on either side, which would allow Io Sky to literally climb over Bayley, which if that's not poetic for what's happening within their group, then I don't know what is. But, you know, her getting the victory in a good match here.
Yeah, I really liked this. I thought it was on the higher end of the Women's Money in the Bank. And the reason for that was I thought they did a good job at paying attention to detail when it came to existing stories within the confines of the match. I really liked the way that Trish and Zoe Stark met Becky in the ramp to get things kicked off, and they tried to take her out in the early going. I like that Trish and Zoe, being a relatively new partnership, that their roles were very clearly defined, that Zoe, you know, despite probably wanting to win herself, was very much willing to put herself aside in order to protect and help Trish Stratus win. You saw her, you know, stand underneath the ladder and try to play keep away for Trish on more than one occasion so that Trish could climb the ladder and get the briefcase. I thought that was a really good touch. And then I particularly liked down the stretch when they isolated Becky, Trish, and Zoe and worked on the outside for a while. Zoe takes out the handcuffs, and you kind of think that they're going for the tried and true spot, which to me would have been a little cliche. I mean, WWE has done this handcuff spot many times. We've seen AEW do it. I wasn't looking forward to that. But I loved that Becky fought out of it because very, very rarely do you see the babyface sort of thwart that that attempt from the heel. So I thought that was a really good moment, and then I especially loved that they brought it full circle and came back to the handcuffs at the end to tie Becky and Bayley in between the two rungs with all their history together. That was a really cool piece, and then Io Sky climbs over Bayley, like you mentioned, to retrieve the briefcase. So I was really high on this match overall. I thought they did a really good job piecing it together and producing it. My only caveat here is just the fact that, you know, I thought this was going to be the year that they put the briefcase on a woman who was very likely to lose, because they've done the failed cash-in with the men many times over. They've never done it with the women. The women have always been successful in their cash-ins. So I thought that this was the year that they would probably try to do it. So to me, it made the most sense that someone like Becky or Trish would win, in the sense that they could cost each other their cash in and have their blow off at SummerSlam. So Io was a bit of a surprise to me, in the sense that I thought of all the women in the match, she seemed the most likely to win and keep the tradition of successful cash ins alive. So with that aside, I mean, if the plan is for the cash-in to be successful, I think Io's a great choice. I love the idea of putting it on her for that reason, and I think she's going to be a really fun briefcase holder, and I think that the banter and breakup with her and Bayley is going to be a lot of fun too, because damage control has kind of been treading water for quite a while.
All right, then we get to the semi-main event, Seth Rollins defeating Finn Balor to retain the World Heavyweight Championship. And this was a match that kind of ended abruptly. I felt like it was good, but it was more of, felt like a Raw match than a pay-per-view match. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, definitely agree. It felt like a TV match. I was disappointed. I mean, you're right. It was a fine match. It was good even. They worked hard. They work very well together. There was nothing wrong with the match, but I think that they had done a pretty darn good job at building up Finn Balor in the last several weeks leading up to Money in the Bank and making him seem like this vicious heel out for revenge, looking to you know, hurt and injure Seth Rollins as payback for what happened at SummerSlam in 2016. There was this viciousness to Finn in the lead up. They were selling it hard on commentary, this idea that Finn had been living with this, no pun intended, demon that he just couldn't control anymore. And I thought that that meant that we were going to get, you know, a heavyweight, pun intended there, a heavyweight title match. And we didn't. We got, just like you said, more of a TV title defense. And it became even less about the story of Finn Balor trying to get his revenge and more about will he or won't he with Damian Priest. And I just didn't care for that. I mean, I thought that, you know, they're going to have so much time to do that with Priest, presuming you know, that he doesn't cash in right away, they're going to have weeks and weeks to do these teases. I would have much preferred that, you know, Finn and Seth just have a back and forth competitive match and Balor beats him clean in the end. Instead, you know, we got 10 minutes of good action and then 2 minutes of Priest teasing a cash in and then some arguing between Priest and Balor. It felt like a means to an end rather than an actual, you know, meaty conclusion to a story. So I was a little disappointed.
And then the main event, the Usos defeating Roman Reigns and Solo Sikoa when Jay pins Roman Reigns, his first pinfall loss since December of 2019, per Michael Cole, which I believe was Baron Corbin, as Corbin will gladly point out.
But no one else. No one else will.
No, of course not. Jey Uso getting the pin leads speculation to Jey Uso versus Roman Reigns at SummerSlam for the championship. It was a good match. It was, you know, your vintage bloodline storytelling type match. The one complaint I have, and it's the complaint I've had the last couple of times we've seen Roman Reigns matches, is the ref bumps. And I think it's more egregious to me because WWE has cut back so significantly on ref bumps in all other matches. Like, the only time they do them now is in Roman Reigns matches, which is kind of like makes you roll your eyes. Not that I would want them to do them in more matches, but I think it just stands out that it happens all the time in his matches. And the other thing is he took another visual pinfall in this match before Jay actually pinned him. And he's done that a couple times now. And I struggle. I wrote about this in my roundtable, which will be out in the newsletter this week. You can't have Roman Reigns be this dominating force who is the best champion we've ever seen, and also the guy who gets pinned in every match, but the ref just gets bumped in and doesn't see it. Like, that, those two are not compatible to me. So I don't know why, other than, like, the moment of the heat of the babyface getting the pin and the fans kind of losing their minds for that, you know, 3 second span. But I don't think it's worth it to do that if you're and this is not the first time. They've done it probably in a half dozen of his matches, him taking a visual pinfall that the ref does not see. And so I guess we're to believe that either that Roman Reigns is both incredibly lucky that all these pins that he takes is not in front of the referee, but also the most dominating champion of our time. And it's like, no, you can't be both. It's got to be one or the other. And so that's where my frustration comes in. Admittedly, it's pretty minor, I think, in the grand scheme of things, but still I thought something worth bringing up in talking about the Usos versus Reigns and Sikoa here.
Yeah, I certainly see that point, and it's a good one. I mean, it's not something I've thought a ton about, but it's something I've definitely noticed. And I think you can make the case for doing the visual pin a few times. Like, I think Cody Rhodes, for example, you can make a strong case for the idea that Reigns escapes, and one day down the line, Cody is going to get his. But I think you make a really strong argument there, especially in this match, because if Jay is going to eventually get the pin anyway, there's really no need for the visual victory. So, yeah, I think that's definitely a strong and valid argument. I'm with you. I liked the match. I thought that it was slow going in the beginning, and that is the name of the game with Roman Reigns matches, with these big main event matches. And I thought they went further than they typically do here. Typically, I find that these Reigns matches really pick up at like the 10 to 12 minute mark, maybe 15 if you really want to push it. But I time all these matches during my coverage for PW Torch, and I didn't think that things really picked up until 20 minutes in. So 20 minutes is when the action started to pick up in pace, and then I believe Jay got the pin just before 33 minutes. So we got just under 13 minutes of sort of high velocity, major action. And everything before that was sort of the slow plodding style that Roman Reigns works and works to a very high degree. Don't get me wrong. I mean, very few people do that style better than Reigns does, but it did go longer than it typically does.
So that was one small thing. But on the positive end, I mean, I loved the callbacks. I loved the trash talking from Roman. I thought that the atmosphere was incredible. The crowd just being so firmly behind the Usos and then occasionally trying to get behind Solo Sikoa, almost in a way where they were encouraging him maybe not to side with Roman. And Roman would give them that snide look to try to quiet them down. And Solo was just largely ignoring it. Thought that was a really, really good touch. One small thing, I find that production and camera work is generally at its best during Bloodline stories and matches. And they rarely miss anything, be it a move, a facial expression, just, unspoken body language. The cameras tend to catch all of it for their stuff. They've done a really good job with that over the course of 3+ years now. But they missed the low blow. And that was such a huge and crucial moment in the match that, you know, Cole had to rewind and throw back to a replay, which kind of slowed down the pace of those final couple of minutes. So it was really unfortunate because that was such a huge moment and also a huge throwback to something that Reigns did to Jay 3 years ago in their first match against each other. So this match was loaded with those callbacks, and most of them I didn't even pick up on until afterward because some of them go way back. I didn't notice until I happened to see it on Twitter earlier today, in fact, that even the finish itself, Jimmy and Jay, their position in the ring, Roman's position in the ring, the corner that the Usos were standing in to execute the frog splash that finished the match, that was a carbon copy, exact replica of the first time Roman Reigns was pinned in 2013, which is really, really cool. So I am still here. I think we've lost Greg again. In fact, he just messaged me to tell me that we did in fact lose him. So to stretch a little bit more with what I was mentioning about that main event, I thought that the situation with the Usos at the end was incredibly cool. I love the fact that they did the callback to the 2013 finish. They also, like I mentioned, the low blow was a callback to Jay and Roman's first match. I believe it was either at it may have been SummerSlam or it might have been the pay-per-view afterwards, September of 2020. So really, really cool callbacks there. They did a couple of other things too. I believe that the super kicks may have been a callback to something. And of course, like I mentioned, the low blow, the turnaround on the low blow was a callback to Roman doing it to Jay. So they really, really went back into the archives and dug through some stuff that the Bloodline had previously done en route to the build to this story. And I thought that was really awesome. Greg, are you back?
Yeah, for sure. I'm back.
Just as
I was having all these troubles with my previous setup, so I went to a new setup this week, and I'm still it's not working for me. So I don't know. I really am running out of ideas about what to do next. So, but we'll keep soldiering on, and we'll keep getting through it, and we'll keep going to the phones. Because I love hearing from you guys, and that's what makes me happy. That's what makes me want to keep doing this week after week, where I just would prefer to throw my headset against the wall in frustration. So Sean from Murfreesboro, Tennessee, is on with us. Sean, thanks for being on the show this week. Always good to hear your thoughts after the pay-per-view. Tell us what you thought of Money in the Bank.
Well, first, Greg, I want to say – please don't leave us. Like, we can't let you leave us. I know there's reasons why you would want to, and I get that, and I understand that completely, but don't do that. And two, it's good to be on with you because I told you, I messaged you, I won't be able to get on next week because I'll be on vacation, so I'm glad I'm getting to talk to you guys now. And Brandon, it's always good to talk to you, man. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you? Thanks for alerting me. I got your message just seconds after Greg informed me that he was gone again, so. Allowed me a moment to recover.
You did a great job. I wanted to go back to what you guys were just talking about because, like, I feel like during that match, and you guys were right on with what you said. Like, The match did plot on, like you said, ran a little too, even though I love the story they tell with Roman matches, that it doesn't even bother me. Like, it's like, all right, it's fine. Like, it's, you know, they're telling such a good story and they're all just doing such a good job in their role that it doesn't, even though it normally would bother me with these, with all these guys and what they're doing, it doesn't really bother me at all. But with the low blow, I think they, if I remember, I feel like they caught it. It's just, they kind of flipped really fast. Cause the reaction Roman had when he kicked out, you could tell he was giving him a low blow. Like, if you're looking at what's going on, it's not hard to say, you could tell he's giving him a low blow because his arm was underneath his, you know, I'm like, it's not hard to see that. I mean, yeah, they didn't show the view that you wanted them to show, but it was still, like, clear that that's what was happening, and Roman showed him, his reaction tells you that's what was happening. So I don't know why it took Cole that long to see that that's what was going on, but I know what you're saying, because they did go to that other, the angle of it, and so it didn't, like, specifically show it, but if you're a smart person, you could tell that's what he's doing, and so I didn't get, are you guys with me on that? Did you guys notice the same thing, or am I way off on that?
It was harder for me to notice in the moment because when I'm covering live, I'm often doing quick glances back and forth between my two screens. So I rely on Michael Cole a lot for those cues because I'm literally usually taking like one glance at the screen, then back at my typing screen. So that's why I missed it. But the way that Cole sold it made me think that everyone missed it.
And Greg, did you think the same thing? What did you think of that?
I don't remember the specific instance, so I will defer to you guys on that.
Okay. But as far as the match itself, it was great. I'm still really iffy on it, because everybody's talking about should Jay be the one to beat Roman for the title and all this kind of stuff. I still am leery on – I don't like him getting pinned there. I know why they did it, and I see the thought behind why they're doing it, and I'm not like 100% OS, you can't do that. I just – I wanted Roman's actual 1-2-3 when the ref's there to actually be at a big event when somebody's beating him for the title. I don't know. I just – when I saw it, I was like, man, it's a cool moment. Jay is doing such a good job right now. Like, this story's been so well told in a lot of different ways. And everybody's – there's still so much intrigue to what they're going to do next. What did you guys think about that overall as a whole? If you were like, would I do that? Should they do that? Are you like, they should have done it, it was fine? Or would you have laid off until a big event when he's losing the title? What'd y'all think about that?
I get the idea that by taking a pin in a tag team situation, it's going to lessen the effect of Reigns, or the impact, I guess, of Reigns eventually getting pinned and losing the title. But I think that's a small consolation for Jey Uso, of all people, being the one to pin Roman Reigns. You know, I think if it had been Kevin Owens or someone else pinning him, I don't think it would have had the same impact. But with Jey Uso being the one to do it and likely leading to Jey Uso versus Roman Reigns in the main event of SummerSlam, I'm totally fine with it. I understand why they did it. I think it was the right move to create a little more interest in and to take the next step in the Bloodline storyline. Whether or not Jay is the one to ultimately beat him, I think you could make the argument for Jay. You could make an argument for Jimmy. You could make an argument for Solo to ultimately be the person who takes the title off of Roman Reigns. But I think having Jay, a member of his own family, beat him is going to force some questions about Roman's place in the Bloodline. So I think not only does it set up Jay versus Roman at SummerSlam, but it also further takes us down the path of that Bloodline explodes storyline that goes along with it. Brandon, what do you think? Could they have gotten here without Roman Reigns taking the pin in this match?
Yeah, a couple things. So I think you nailed my thought, Greg, perfectly, which is that I'm fine with it because it was Jay. If this were Kevin Owens, like you mentioned, I don't think it would have worked. I think it works because it's Jay, because throughout the course of this story, as challengers fell and Roman's reign, no pun intended, became more significant. I think that there were two names that kept coming up as potential people to dethrone him, and that was Cody Rhodes and Jey Uso. And there are very strong arguments for both. Now, so far as we've heard, the tentative plan for WrestleMania next year is still Roman and Cody. And maybe that's when they do it, maybe it's not. But I don't think Jey Uso is going to be the one to beat Roman Reigns. So, if that's the case, then I think it's important that he gets his comeuppance in a different way. And being the first guy to pin him in 3.5 years is that. So that's why I'm okay with it. The second little point that I'll make there is they haven't made a big deal out of Roman not being pinned until just recently. It's always been about the championship and his historic run as champion. But I don't think they've outright said, oh, Roman hasn't been pinned since December 15th, 2019, until maybe even last night. So I don't think that you were supposed to get too hung up on how long it's been since he's lost. I think the big prize, the big talking point is still how long he's been champion.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. Sean, any other thoughts on Money in the Bank that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, that was good, Brandon. I want to say, Brandon, too, I love your reports. They're some of the most thorough reports I've ever seen on pay-per-view stuff, so I really appreciate that, too. Going back to the one thing I want to say about the Shayna Ronda that you guys were talking about is no matter how that happened or no matter what stories have come out since then, I know it's hard in the moment, but just turn Shayna face and have Ronda be the heel. That's it. It's easy. Don't make it hard. Nobody, like you said, Brandon, nobody wants to cheer Ronda at all right now. No one. So have Ronda be a babyface on the way out. And number one, if she's going to go out, if Shayna beats Ronda, I don't know. It's just been, for a babyface to lose on her way out just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. No one, they don't like her anyway. I don't know. It's just weird to me. I wanted to bring that up. But so that's really all I had on Money in the Bank. Greg, can I ask a couple other questions away from Money in the Bank? Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to Friday on SmackDown. And I know I was on there talking about the Charlotte stuff with Asuka and Bianca. Guys, that's a mess. That's an absolute mess. Bianca, you know, the way they planned that segment out was just really, really bad. The match between Charlotte and Asuka was even worse. Charlotte is in a horrible spot right now. They keep landing on the fact that she's a big star. I don't care. Yeah, she's a big star, but she is in just an awful role for her. She's not good in it. The match was bad. Two horrible moonsaults. Just Bianca looked bad coming out and attacking them the way she did. What did you guys think about that segment? And if they go to a triple threat, I don't even know if I want any of them to win. I don't know. They're in a bad spot. What do you think about that whole trio? I just don't like any of them right now at all.
It's hard to believe that they dropped the ball so drastically on Bianca Belair. I thought she was a surefire future star, and I think she is in some ways, but I think she's also been underdeveloped in some ways as a character that's really starting to manifest itself on television. And so, you know, that's one issue. Asuka is very limited in the ways that they present her. So that's kind of an issue as well. And Charlotte Flair has all kinds of issues too. I mean, she's a great wrestler in certain respects, but as a character, she leaves a lot to be desired. So individually, they have some warts. When you put them together, they seem to be magnified. And that's not to say they don't have talent. We've seen all three of them excel at different times. It might be just one of those situations, Brandon, when you put them together, it's a struggle because they all have very dominant personalities. And when you put them together, they just don't mix very well. Is that kind of how you see it, or what else is at play here with these three?
I think it's just a confluence of bad circumstances for all of them. I mean, Charlotte Flair is very clearly miscast. She's been turned way too much. I mean, we're you know – we can put her in the same conversation as the Big Show now, and I don't even really think that that's a stretch anymore. I mean, and the worst thing about a Charlotte turn is that it doesn't even happen. Like, at least when Big Show was turning, he would, you know, if he was turning babyface, he'd beat up a bad guy. If he was turning heel, he'd beat up a good guy. Charlotte just shows up one week, and suddenly she's either a heel or a babyface, and no one is any the wiser. And you're kind of left to figure it out on your own over the course of a couple weeks, depending on who she's wrestling. So she's got that issue going for her. She is a very, very natural heel, and I think that she needs to be in that role, especially with the current crop of talent. I just think that the way she wrestles, the way she cuts promos, everything about her just screams heel. And when she's in a babyface role, I think it makes things very challenging for her. I think it's always an uphill climb. So that's the Charlotte situation. Bianca Belair had this really impressive run as women's champion. She continues to grow in the ring. She seems to have a really strong connection with the audience, and yet time and time again, as women's champion, they fail to give her anything compelling to do. And so it ended up necessitating that they pull the championship from her for a fresh start, except that she never really got to shine as champion because they just never had any major programs for her. And that brings us to Asuka, who was the quote-unquote beneficiary of the necessary change from Bianca, except that Asuka never really turned heel either. I mean, she was a babyface against Bianca at WrestleMania. She spit some mist in Bianca's face, but she was still cheered. I mean, people think the mist is cool. I don't think that they find it to be an overtly heel act, and especially when, you know, when she actually won the title, the way she misted Belair in her title victory was unique, and it was cool. She didn't spit in her face. She spit it in her own hands. And so that was something that, you know, we don't see very often. I think the crowd thought it was fun. So you're getting off on the wrong foot right away there, and then you immediately don't really have anything for Asuka to do except to be big-footed by Charlotte Flair, who comes out and says she's the champion even when she's not the champion. So, yeah, it's a mess.
Well said and well put. I think you covered all the bases there with that. Sean, anything else for us tonight?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk AEW real fast because I know we won't get into it too much. And I wanted to get my point out there because it's been kind of driving me crazy with a lot of the post-shows. Not with the post-shows because Wade does – I mean, you guys all do a great job. My thing is with AEW, okay, I think my main issue that I'm having with them, and Todd really doesn't even bring it up either. He's been saying how good the matches are and a lot of the stuff. Yes, that's true. The matches have been good. The thing about AEW that I think bothers me the most about all this stuff, because I think the ratings are going to continue to tumble because of a lot of the stuff they're doing, and I think that's a problem that needs to be addressed, is the titles. None of the titles in AEW mean anything to me right now. They don't feel – none of them feel important at all. And isn't that the whole point of wrestling, professional wrestling, to make the titles feel like they mean something? In AEW, the main title with MJF, yes, he's a great heel. I love MJF. I love Adam Cole. What they're doing with him and Adam Cole, yes, it's funny. Yes, it could be leading to something. But the goal is Adam Cole, I think, was a face that could have beaten MJF, and now they've ruined that, in my opinion. I don't think anybody wants him to beat MJF right now. And I don't know, yes, they could go to someone later on, and it could mean something. But even with the title, I feel like they've gone away from what the title means and how important the title is. And all the rest of the titles, tell me which one means anything. The tag team titles mean nothing. TNT title means nothing. The main women's title, Toni Storm is on it, has it just because Jamie Hayter's hurt. Jamie Hayter has meant something. Like, she's been good, but now she's out. Hopefully when she gets back, it'll mean something. The TBS title, you know, I don't have anything against Chris Statlander, but she doesn't mean anything right now. They've done nothing to build her up. It's just – that's my main thing with AEW that I'm having an issue with, and I want you guys to just kind of tell me what your thoughts are and what you're thinking about it, because I think that's the main problem with AEW. And I'm going to get off here and get ready for my vacation. Greg, I appreciate what you do, man. Brandon, I always appreciate talking to you guys, and I appreciate you taking my call, as always.
Excellent. Enjoy your vacation, Sean. Stay safe out there.
Yeah, definitely.
I think this is something, Brandon, that people could kind of see coming as AEW added more titles, there just wasn't the time then to invest in each one the way that each title should be invested in. And I think that's where the frustration for me comes in is, if you have so many titles that I can't keep track of who's champion at any given moment, that's a problem. And that's kind of where I've reached with AEW. And so, you know, MJF obviously is the top champion. He's the, you know, comes across as the biggest star. Adam Cole is coming off a cold feud with Chris Jericho that's kind of hurt him, but he had some good mic work with MJF recently that helped him. But yeah, beyond that, I don't feel like any of the titles are really in a position of strength right now in AEW.
Well, the international title is probably in the
Orange
in the
Cassidy.
Best
yeah, he's done a really nice job. They've done a nice job telling that story about how incrementally with each match he seems to be getting more and more hurt, and yet somehow still retains. So you're kind of waiting for that moment for him to lose.
Yeah, they've done a good job there, and I want to give them credit for that, but at the same time, you kind of have to acknowledge how ridiculous it is that really the title with the most not prestige. I mean, I think that the world championship still has plenty of prestige behind it, but the international title, save for the world championship, has kind of become that de facto secondary title because of the story they've told with Orange Cassidy and the quality of matches that he's having with it. But I think you're right. I mean, there's too many championships. There's an unsanctioned FTW title that now it appears as though Hook and Jungle Boy are going to feud over, which I think is ridiculous if the title isn't sanctioned. And then you have all the ROH championships. And I applaud AEW for doing a better job as of late in keeping the ROH talent and the ROH matches segregated from the main show. I think that's what you want to do. But a lot of those wrestlers are needed for your quote-unquote main roster, especially now with Collision in the fold. And so the issue that you have is that even though Samoa Joe, for example, is the Ring of Honor television champion, he's showing up on Collision on a weekly basis with that title over his shoulder or around his waist. And even if that title isn't being defended on AEW TV, the mere fact that he has it and he's carrying it around on AEW television tells me that there are too many championships out there. Because if you've got so many titles under your umbrella that guys that aren't even part of, that guys wrestling in other promotions are carrying those promotion titles on your show, it's easy to get confused. It's easy to water down those titles, and it's too much. It's the same reason I don't love the cross promotion with New Japan. I mean, I thought Forbidden Door was an incredibly good show. I enjoyed the heck out of watching it. I absolutely adored Kenny Omega versus Will Ospreay. I could heap tons of praise on that match, but the caveat to all of this when I say that is that I don't love taking a month off from your weekly in-house storylines to tell brief stories about a series of what basically amounts to exhibition matches. And I understand why they do it, and I understand that it's been a big success. It's just not my favorite thing. And the way they treat titles falls very much into that category for me. The last thing I'll say about this, because Sean brought up, there hasn't been a ton of pushback on a lot of the Torque shows. Todd Martin, it was either on this week's Fix or last week's Fix, mentioned a incredibly good point about AEW. And it's something that I have thought for a long time, but I struggle for whatever reason to pinpoint it, because it was always, for a long time, it's been a feel for me. Something has felt off about AEW. And it clicked when Todd said it. And it's simply that for a lot of people, and I certainly fall in this category,
it feels like too much of AEW has no stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simple. You'd think I'd be able to just come up with that, but if you sit with it for a minute, you kind of think, you know, you go up and down the card and you're like, well, yeah, wait a minute. Like, nothing feels terribly important because everyone sort of feels in on the joke. And the point that he made to accompany that was, look out at the crowd on Wednesday's episode of Dynamite. And, like, you know, you have like an anti-CM Punk sign, but then you had like two signs for video games, and you had another sign that was, you know, about comedy. And then one thing I've noticed, I don't know if there are any Torch viewers or listeners here who are completely enamored with I Think You Should Leave, starring Tim Robinson on Netflix. Season 3 is out now. But for the past few weeks on Dynamite, people have been bringing signs with I Think You Should Leave sketches on them. Like, I get a kick out of it, but that just tells me you're not taking the show seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think the frustration, too, is this is all happening while we're also complaining about having too many titles. So if your matches feel like they don't have meaning and you have that many titles, that kind of, like, compounds the problem almost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point that Todd makes and that you reiterate here about the stakes, and it's going to be something I'm going to be watching out for in the next few weeks that I'm watching Dynamite and Collision as well. We've got a couple of emails. We've got a couple more phone calls, so we'll try to get through these quickly here since we're pushing an hour and a half now. Azan had emailed us in. We had a bit of a backlog. He emailed a couple times while I was on vacation, so we'll get to his latest email here. And then the other couple of emails he sent are not time-sensitive, so we'll get to those perhaps another week. But his email this week says, "Hello, Greg and Brandon. Number one, isn't it funny how Liv and Raquel first won tag belts after Trish's turn on Becky, and now they won belts again after Shayna's turn on Ronda? Does this make Liv and Raquel more of the weak team?" Yeah, I hadn't put it together that that's how they won their titles the first time around.
Me either.
You know, and I kind of made the point about how weak it makes them after this. So, but I think you made the point that there's so little investment in the women's tag titles that I'm not sure this will register with the general fan base.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly had completely forgotten by now that their first title win came at the turn. So, but it makes sense. It's ringing a bell now that I hear it, and that's a really good point that he brings up. Yeah, I mean, if they want to make something out of these titles and something out of the Raquel and Liv run, then absolutely they're gonna have some work to do to try to give them some big clean wins and build up the run.
Second question from Azan. Do you think people were too hard on the idea of Bullet Club Gold at first, but now they became a highlight of weekly AEW TV? I'm going to say a no to that now that the Gun Club has been added to Bullet Club Gold. And I was thinking about this as I was watching the interview segment with Jay White, Juice Robinson, and the Gun Club on Collision. The Gun Club is kind of like the team that the original Bullet Club would have made fun of, and now they're in the Bullet Club. And that just feels so sad to me.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. My biggest thing. You're absolutely right. My biggest thing with Bullet Club Gold is it feels derivative. It feels like a knockoff. It feels like a continuation past shelf life. And most importantly, it feels like a major hindrance to Jay White, who I think is much better than this faction, and much better than the three guys he's paired with.
And the third question from Azan, when it comes to the drama between Finn and Damian Priest, who should be the face and heel coming out of things, from Azan from St. Louis? Thanks, Azan. And again, we'll get to those other questions that you had another time. I definitely think Priest should be the baby face. I say definitely, and then I kind of hem and haw about it. But my initial thought is I thought he was really showed strong babyface chops when he first started teaming with Bad Bunny. And I think they could revisit that. I think that would be my preference is is Priest as a babyface, Balor as the heel?
Yeah, I was talking to Frank Pediani a bit about this earlier today over Twitter, and he's very much in your camp, very much of the belief that Priest should be the babyface. And I think I am too, but I just have hesitation about the timeline for it. So to me, I think that Priest definitely has shown that he can work well as a babyface. The problem that I have is that he's only just finally started to take off as a heel. Like, Priest, mm-hmm. Priest managed to get over pretty decently with Bad Bunny, but he got really cold after that. Like, so cold that he was not even being utilized a whole lot for a period there. And then they turned him heel, and Judgment Day kind of looked like a big flop in the beginning, so it didn't really feel like much of anything, and it didn't feel like it was helping Priest in any way. He was just sort of there. And then, as Judgment Day gained steam and Rhea Ripley became a big deal and Dominic Mysterio became a big deal, Priest finally started to come into his own again. And then they had the Bad Bunny feud, which did, you know, wonders for him. The issue right now is that I think that Priest is still on the upswing as a heel and hasn't reached the crescendo of where the crowd is ready to cheer him again yet. I don't see that when Priest comes out, that there's a tide building for him to be a babyface. And so my worry, if they turn him now, is that he's going to just immediately flounder and fall back to the position that he was in before Judgment Day. Maybe he doesn't, but that's my fear. Now, on the flip side, Finn's been turned, you know, a number of times. I don't think there's a ton of steam there for him as a babyface unless you plan to reintroduce the demon character regularly. So that's why I say I side with the idea that it should be Priest. I just think the timing's off.
Yeah, and I think you could argue there's more upside with Priest right now as a babyface than with Balor. That would be kind of my take
kind
of as well. All right, back to the phones, 410 area code. Reverend Keith from Baltimore, Maryland is with us. Reverend Keith, thanks for joining us tonight. Curious to get your thoughts on Money in the Bank.
How you doing, Greg? Long time. I haven't been on this show since April 23rd.
I know. It's been a while. It's good to hear from you.
Yes, sir. It is. How are you, Mr. Brandon?
Good. How are you?
Good. Always good. Listen, I thought that Money in the Bank was a very good premium live event. It set the stage for many feuds to come. I really was shocked at the Shayna Ronda Rousey situation because that came from out of nowhere. But in listening to Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer early today, Meltzer was stating that Ronda has a hard out, that she will probably be taking some time off around SummerSlam or right after SummerSlam. So I think they wanted to have this match happen right away. So that's why they had to turn as abruptly as they did. So it was quite interesting. I thought that it was a shocker. What were your thoughts about this? And I know you alluded somewhat to it earlier, but what were your thoughts on the turn itself? And do you think that this will propel Shayna after she concludes the feud with Ronda?
I mean, you hope so. I think Baszler is another one, and I'll use that word again, has significant upside. I think that she's been underutilized for a lot of her run in WWE on the main roster, and I hope that the feud with Rousey kind of propels her back to more of that Killer Instinct character. If she is going to be a heel, which, again, you know, we talked about earlier, Brandon brought up, that was kind of a heel move for her to make in attacking Ronda Rousey. So if she can, like, beat Rousey at SummerSlam and kind of use that as a springboard to a more dominating heel persona, I think that would be great. You know, the turn was shocking. I don't think anyone saw it coming. And I think in that moment, people were excited to see a turn, but upon reflection, and we've done some reflection on it here tonight, it didn't seem the right timing. And I know, you know, the reports out there, we talked about that, about Rousey being done after SummerSlam, which sort of necessitated this move. But you just hope that it doesn't hurt Baszler that the turn came a little earlier. I think that kind of sums up what we talked about, right, Brandon?
Yeah, I think it does for the most part. My fear going into this feud now is just that you have Shayna Baszler in a position where logically she should be the heel and Ronda should be the babyface, but it doesn't seem like there's really much of any interest from the crowd to cheer Ronda Rousey. So that puts you in a really precarious position and enters you into a scenario where it's very possible that there's just minimal interest in the match, which I think would be really unfortunate, because on paper it does seem like a cool opportunity. And I really do hope that it can be used to propel Shayna Baszler, because Greg, like you mentioned, I would love to see, you know, the NXT style killer return. I think that the women's mm-hmm. division could really use someone like that, and it would benefit them in a huge way to see a reinvigorated Shayna Baszler, you know, running the table on the women's division.
All right, Roden, Keith, your second question or comment for us tonight?
Yes, I would like to see the Killer Instinct and Shayna Baszler be revisited. She hasn't been the same on the main roster, so we'll see where this goes, you know, upon completion of her feud with Ronda. And I think Ronda does need to take some time off, because she's just not the same. Since she's had her baby, she's come back. She doesn't have that killer instinct, and she doesn't pose any threat or any intimidation like she did back in, you know, 2019, 2020. So, you know, it'd be good for her to spend time with the family and get away from it all. Now, moving along, I just want to touch basis on what you were discussing right after you got off the phone with Sean about the Damian Priest situation. Now, I was happy to say that I had predicted both Priest and EO, while everybody else was looking at Logan Paul. Logan Paul didn't need it. LA Knight, the verdict is out on how far his push goes, even though he is really over right now. Huge. And I followed his career from TNA, so it's good to see it. He's a great person, good character, fun-loving guy. So it's good to see him getting all of his just desserts right now. But getting back to Damian Priest, I think that they're going to tease the dissension between he and Finn Balor. They're going to keep it running for a little while, because when you think about it, it was really no need for Priest to come out the last 2 minutes of that match. It's bad enough that they were rushing. They only gave him 12 minutes, 36 seconds in that title match with Seth, and they could have gone 20 minutes. But to have Priest come out and tease dissension with Finn to have the distraction finished, I thought that was unnecessary. So we'll see. I think it's going to last a couple weeks. I do believe that Priest will be the baby face in it all. You know, he was good, like you said, when he was with Bad Bunny. He also was exciting after a live event recently. He broke character, and he and Seth had shook hands. Matter of fact, it was right after the Raw show a couple weeks ago when Seth retained over Priest. And right after the camera stopped rolling, Seth commended Priest on the match and asked Priest to come out, and Priest acknowledged him, and they shook hands. So I can see Priest getting back as a baby. But how long do you think that Priest will hold the Money in the Bank briefcase? And I'll pose this question to you, Brandon LeClaire.
It's a good question, because my thought was that we were going to see a cash in yesterday, just because WWE has really liked to get rid of one of those briefcases right away. And, you know, obviously it would have had to have been Priest, just because there wasn't a women's title match on the card. But yeah, it wouldn't have surprised me to see it happen last night. I think that they will be tempted to dump one of the briefcases very, very early. I just don't know which one it's going to be. The thing is if Priest cashes in, obviously it sort of needs to be on Seth. I don't think that they're going to send him to SmackDown to cash in on Roman. And I don't think, unless unless they have a plan to put him in a prominent position as either the U.S. or Intercontinental Champion, I don't think that they'll have him go after one of those, you know, second-tier titles. So I assume the cash-in is going to come in on Seth. I guess I think he probably goes first rather than EO. So I don't know. I mean, maybe a month or two? I don't think they want to have two briefcases out there for a long period of time. They never do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually see both Damian Priest and Io Sky cashing in successfully. I don't see a really good reason, unless you do, I don't know, Io Sky tries to cash in and Bayley costs her, or Damian Priest tries to cash in and Finn Balor costs him. They both have very similar situations within their group that could lead to problems with their cash-in, boiling tension, although I think Bayley and Io Sky are much further along in that than Finn Balor and Damian Priest.
I could hide that somehow.
I'm sorry, Brandon?
That was me.
Did you? Who? Oh, I thought that was you. Somebody. Okay.
No. I heard it too.
Yeah,
though.
So I... Yeah, okay. I'm not hearing things then. I think the problems could be in the cash with the dissension, but I would definitely have both successfully cash in. Reverend Keith, we'll go back to you for your final question or comment for us tonight.
It was a delight to see Roman Reigns get pinned after not being pinned since December of 2019. I thought that took a lot of courage and boldness from the writing team, the producers, the agents, all parties involved. I thought it made for a good finish to a very successful main event in Money in the Bank last night. I do believe, however, that this will lead to Jay versus Roman at SummerSlam at Ford Field. However, Roman this time will get the pin on Jay. As a lead-in to that, I can see them doing an angle in Madison Square Garden this Friday, whereas maybe they try to, and perhaps successfully, injure Jimmy to get to Jay, to add more intrigue to the matchup with Roman, because you know Roman and Solo are going to be out for their receipts after the main event last night. So this will take this great story to another level now that Roman has been pinned, he's been beaten, he's no longer invincible. How do you see the next angle leading up to the match with Jay taking shape beginning Friday in Madison Square Garden?
Oh, by the way, that outburst was Sean. I hadn't muted him, and he's still listening to the show. So... I don't think he realized he was on, and I didn't realize he was still on. So that was my fault. Just, you know, we're going through all the potential issues tonight again. So Reigns and Jay, like, I think there's going to be a lot of intrigue. I think Friday is going to do a huge rating for SmackDown, because I think there's going to be a lot of intrigue to see what is the reaction of Roman Reigns to getting pinned, and not just getting pinned, but getting pinned by Jey Uso. Like, I think there's going to be, you know, this is, we talk about December 2019 was the last time that Roman Reigns was pinned. We don't know how he's going to react to this. We don't know how the leader of the Bloodline is going to react to taking a pinfall loss, even though it's in a tag team match. Is he going to go off on Solo and blame him? Is he going to go off on Jimmy and Jay? Is he going to go off on the Wise Man? So I really don't know what the next step is. I'm intrigued to find out, but I do think, Brandon, that it's going to be a big rating this week on SmackDown.
Yeah, I do too. And it's a good point, too, to bring up the fact that they are at Madison Square Garden this week. So you know that WWE is going to want a newsworthy show. They know, you know, that they're going to want to put on something special for that crowd. So I do expect them to have something major in terms of storyline development. And I think it'll be a cool moment regardless of what they decide to do. I don't have a strong inkling one way or the other of where they go outside of thinking that it is going to be Jey Uso challenging Roman at SummerSlam. I don't know where they go from there. So I'm really excited for Friday and to see where they hit.
All right, Reverend Keith, we appreciate the phone call, and it's good to hear from you again.
Yes, it is, and I'm looking forward to seeing Brock Lesnar return here tomorrow night, and I think that's going to set up his match with Cody at SummerSlam. I'm looking forward to seeing him, and I know the arena will light up when his fireworks hit, so I'll have more on that next Sunday. Take care. God bless. Have a good week, gentlemen.
All right. Thank you, Reverend Keith. Do the same.
Thanks.
Brandon, we got one more email to get to here, and it's from John. And I'll say the same thing to him that I said to Izan. I know he's got a couple emails in the hopper. One of them we'll get to next week, but I want to read the Money in the Bank one this week since it's a little more time sensitive. He says, hi, hope you're doing well. I thought I'd give my own thoughts on last night's Money in the Bank. I thought it was generally an excellent show with both Money in the Bank matches delivering great action, storyline development, drama, high stakes, and satisfying winners. I've got to be honest with you, Damian Priest was in my top three favorites for the men's match along with Logan Paul and LA Knight because he's not been as prominently featured in TV in recent weeks and has taken the pin a few times, but him winning didn't feel out of place because Judgment Day has been a prominent faction, and it wasn't that long ago that Priest was earmarked to be the breakout star of Judgment Day and potentially get a main event solo run. I don't think LA Knight most needed to win, especially if you're embracing him as a babyface. I would have liked to have him win, but his push has been so organic that I feel him having a sort of Daniel Bryan trajectory, where we have to want to root for him to get every little opportunity until he finally wins the big one, would be best, rather than guaranteeing him a title opportunity. In contrast, I called Io Sky winning the women's Money in the Bank match because the match is best utilized elevating people, and the other established veterans could get title shots on their own. And Io now has so many possibilities for advancement going forward, including damage control as a whole, and maybe they break up, and she has a great singles run, maybe Io versus Asuka. The Bloodline tag match was slow to start, but it became so compelling and emotionally satisfying at the end when Roman was pinned for the first time in over 3 years. However, now that he's taken the pin, I think it gives away that Roman won't be losing the title anytime soon and won't be taking another pin for a very long time. Although if he takes a bunch of pins, sort of like a domino effect after this, it could offer great story potential. It was also interesting that it was Jey who pinned him, and I guess that means it's Jey versus Roman at SummerSlam. I rarely think this, but personally I think a title change should happen if you do this match. That is because if one person is best suited to be the one who overcomes Roman, I believe it's Jey. Also, we've never seen Roman without the title, and the Bloodline walls have been crumbling all around him. But I think you should go one step further and have his historic title reign end, and then we see how he responds essentially to being completely naked and vulnerable. Maybe he takes time off after losing the title, and the feud with the Usos is reignited towards the end of the year. Other matches on the show were fine and what I'd expect. Question. Given that Roman's titles haven't been a focus for quite a while now, compared to the family dynamics, head of the table, etc., how would you write the story so Jey and Jimmy organically have motivation to want to win them? So we'll take a pause here. John has one other question, but a lot of the stuff he says we largely agree with, Brandon. Although the assumption in the question is an interesting one, that the titles now haven't been the focus for Roman. The focus has been what's going on within the Bloodline, what's been going on within his family. And it is kind of an interesting view that way. I think the motivating factor for Jimmy and Jey is just going to be to, I don't know if humiliate is the right word, but to take Roman Reigns down a peg. And what's going to do that is taking the titles from him more than anything else. I mean, the titles make him the head of the table, give him the power that he has over everybody else in the family. So if Jimmy or Jey or whomever take those titles from him, I think that signifies a shift, a dramatic shift, more so than has already happened in the power dynamics within the Bloodline. So I think even if the titles have not been front and center of Roman Reigns' mind of late, I think the Usos know that taking those titles from him will do just that. What are your thoughts on that, Brandon?
Yeah, I'm with you completely. I think that this came up a lot during the Cody Rhodes program heading into WrestleMania, that people thought it felt a little off or felt a little bit different because they were talking so much about the titles, and so much of Roman's presentation on television for so many months had been not about his challengers and not about the championships, but about the story between he and his family, and whether they were with him or if they were straying. And you know, for a long time it centered around Sami Zayn in particular, and that was certainly much more so about the bloodline than it was about the Universal Championship. So I think I agree with the general point that there's been a need to find ways to work title challengers into the bloodline storyline to continue that arc while also maintaining that the challenger is in pursuit of the championship and not just getting wrapped up in the familial drama. So yeah, I agree with that as a general point, and I also think that as far as Jimmy and Jay go, I mean, short of just wanting to be champion because that's what every wrestler should strive for, it is exactly what you said. If you usurp the tribal chief, if you take his championship, if you take the thing that makes him who he is, then, you know, you can watch him crumble before your eyes. I mean, the victory besides just getting to hold the title above your head is taking that title from your, you know, megalomaniac cousin and watching his sharp decline as a result.
The second part of John's email, it would seem odd, given how personal this feud is, to have either Jay or Jimmy suddenly want to win his championship other than the prestige of being champion. So I'm hoping that their motivation is more than a generic, you're the champion and I want it sort of thing, because I need to know why the championships are important to Jimmy or Jay if that's the direction they go. The titles haven't really even been mentioned for weeks, so what I think may be the best is if Jimmy or Jay tell Roman that his whole stronghold on the bloodline has revolved around him being Universal Undisputed Champion, and when Jay pinned him at Money in the Bank, they realized to truly make Roman more vulnerable than ever and to make him truly learn to respect and value his family again. One of them must dethrone him, and that requires winning his championship, and maybe they can get their real cousin back once he's lost everything. I have faith that they will find a way to make the championships feel important again, and I think if it's Jay versus Roman at SummerSlam, Jay should win, although you could have Roman cheat again, but I'd only do that if you separate the Usos and Roman until WrestleMania time, possibly due to Roman using his influence and part-time freedom to avoid them for months, and perhaps have them traded to Raw. And that's when Jay wins the Rumble and finally defeats the head of the table at WrestleMania. Question, where do you think the tension between Priest and Balor go after Money in the Bank? Wow, that was a sharp left turn. I think, Brandon, you know, the tension between Priest and Balor is something that we're going to continue to ramp up, and it's almost similar to the bloodline in that Roman is the de facto leader because he's the champion. That's what makes him the leader, and nobody questions that. I think for the Judgment Day, Finn Balor has been the accepted leader of the group. No one questions that, and now all of a sudden, just like Jay pinning Roman kind of turns things on its head, I think that Damian Priest becoming Money in the Bank briefcase holder on the same show that Finn Balor loses to Seth Rollins has the potential to change the power dynamics within the Judgment Day. And I think we're going to see that tension continue to build, especially if Priest wins the title. And now he's the champion within the group, just like, you know, we talked about if Jay wins the champion, that's going to significantly shift the power dynamic within the bloodline. So I do see some pretty significant parallels between these two groups and where they could be headed in the next weeks and months.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think that there certainly could be a power struggle if Priest were to win the championship, or even with him holding the briefcase. I think what we're going to see is more of what we saw a few weeks back between Priest and Balor, in that a growing sense of jealousy from Balor. Essentially, the idea that Priest is looking for Balor to support him and be by his side 100% as he contemplates when and where he's going to cash in this contract. And Finn is growing probably more and more impatient and more lackadaisical about throwing his hat in the ring to support
Priest. And I think that is going to be the source of tension. They've already done it a couple of times in backstage segments, so I think they're going to continue to build on that.
All right, Brandon, I appreciate you joining me here tonight to break down Money in the Bank with callers and emailers. Before I let you go, let listeners know where and when they can find your work on the Torch and how they can find you on Twitter, so long as it is still a viable social media network by the time this recording comes out.
Yeah, certainly an important caveat to mention there. So you can follow me on Twitter for the time being, at BLeClaire12. And as far as my work for The Torch, I cover all WWE premium live events as well as AEW pay-per-views. So it has been a busy couple of months going from the big Backlash show in Puerto Rico to the Saudi show to Double or Nothing to Forbidden Door and now Money in the Bank. So it's been a crazy few months here covering shows for the Torch, but I try to provide as much detailed live coverage as possible, as well as some real-time analysis. Typically, I can get that analysis in real-time for WWE pay-per-views or PLEs, but for AEW, I usually have to go back and add my thoughts and feelings on the show after the fact, because their matches are just so fast and furious that it's impossible to keep up if I were to stop and try to get thoughts down. So a little different formatting for the two, but I try my best to make it detailed and thoughtful as I go through. Had a lot of fun doing that, so you can always check those reports out on CWTorch.com, and then you can hear me occasionally here with Greg, and also pretty frequently with Wade on the post shows for Raw, SmackDown, and occasionally Dynamite as well.
A lot of heavy lifting for the Torch. We appreciate your work, Brandon, and I appreciate you joining me here tonight.
Absolutely, it was a ton of fun. Really fun show to review, and happy to do it.
Excellent. And we'll be back here on Wrestling Night America next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern. So get those emails in, wnialivecast@gmail.com. If you're tuning in live, you can call us up, 515-605-9345. We'd love to hear from you. We'll have another co-host from the Torch family joining me next week. So I hope you can join us, too. You can find me on Twitter, at Greg M. Parks. I am Torch columnist Greg Parks. Until next week, if it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America.